Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. Hello, you're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM and you're listening to Little Atoms with me, Richard Sanderson, and with Neil Denny. And Neil's going to tell you who we've got on the show today.
Thanks, Richard. Tonight we're welcoming back Jim Baggett to the show, who Richard and I interviewed about just under 2 years ago, I think it was. Jim Baggett has been studying and writing about the history of physics for nearly 20 years and has won awards for his scientific research and his scientific writing. His previous books have been widely acclaimed and include A Beginner's Guide to Reality, Beyond Measure, and Atomic, The First War of Physics and the Secret History of the Atom Bomb, which we discussed on that earlier show. Jim's latest book is The Quantum Story, A History in 40 Moments. So, Jim, welcome back to Little Atoms, first of all.
Great to be back. Thanks for inviting me.
So, the subtitle of this book is The Quantum Story, so it's a history of quantum physics, which we're gonna rush through in over the next 25 minutes. A very, very brief pit stop over the entire history, hopefully. A history in 40 moments. Why? Let's talk about the 40 moments idea, first of all. Why did you decide to do it in that format?
Well, actually, once you've got your head around the fact that you want to write a book about the entire history of quantum physics from about 1900 to the present day, you're immediately challenged with how on earth you're going to do that. And having mulled it over for a period, I decided that perhaps the best thing to do was to pick a number of key moments in time. These might have been meetings between eminent physicists or conferences or even publications that resonated, that were turning points in this history. And I'd originally started with 50 and decided that was way too long for a book, and we've ended up with 40.
So, well, we should get straight in. We should dive straight into the beginning. Let's talk first of all about the the first. In fact, let's stop slightly before that. Let's talk a little slightly about James Clerk Maxwell and the idea of electromagnetism first of all, just as a very brief interlude before we get into the actual early quantum theory.
Yes, we start with the easy stuff. James Clerk Maxwell's work on electromagnetic radiation was effectively the culmination of a very long period of work and study on electromagnetism itself, and that work culminated with Maxwell's theoretical structure, which is effectively an elaborate structure connecting electric fields and magnetic fields, really intertwining them in a kind of magical dance almost, so that as electric fields moved forward, they begat a magnetic field, which begat an electric field, and so on. Very elaborate and rather beautiful once written down in a certain way, to a mathematician at least. But there was absolutely no doubt study of those equations pointed fairly unambiguously to the idea that light, electromagnetic radiation, was a wave. It was effectively a wave theory of light. Some fundamental parameters in the theory, when multiplied together, gave effectively a clear indication of a maximum speed for that light of C, which is what is well known today as the speed of light.
Parallel to that, then, is also this idea, because you mentioned the idea of the wave, and we will have talked on the programme before about the idea of the early quantum theory being this sort of juxtaposition between the idea of the wave and the particle. At the same time as Maxwell, really, is the very beginnings of the theory of the atom. So there's this, you speak in the book about this battle going on between sort of various physicists who think that matter is continuous, basically, yep. And then there's this idea coming in about the idea of the particle of,
well,
of
there
the
were,
atom.
There were two around the turn of the century, around the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. There was actually a number of debates running about the nature of light and matter, material substance. One set of arguments had it that material substance was continuous. Matter just sort of formed an uninterrupted, indivisible stuff that, in effect, a little bit like energy, flowed harmoniously from one form to another. And to counter that, there were a growing set of arguments building around, particularly the Austrian physicist Ludwig Boltzmann, who argued that it was possible to calculate thermodynamic quantities on the basis of the statistics of motions of atoms and molecules as though they were discrete entities. And this was quite a major point of debate. I mean, we have major points of debate going on now in the 21st century, but this was then the equivalent back in those days. Great intellects ranged on either side of this particular debate. And in the end, Planck, an ardent supporter of effectively continuous theories of energy transformation and of matter, actually then, as a result of his own theoretical studies, became an ardent atomist and an ardent supporter of the idea, ultimately, that energy could actually form into discrete lumps called quanta.
So, well, there you go. You've raised the idea of the quanta, the discrete packets of energy. Now let's talk a little bit then about let's bring in Niels Bohr, because then Niels Bohr takes the idea of the quantum theory on to the actual atom to look within. Now we not only have we got this idea that matter is made up of, well, at the time what they thought, indivisible particles, but then J.J. Thomson has discovered the concept of the electron, so we know that actually the atom is divisible, or at least it has an internal. So let's look at Niels Bohr's taking it into the atom.
Well, we move the history forward to about 1913, building on the work of not only J.J. Thomson but also Ernest Rutherford in particular in Manchester. Was a body of evidence that was beginning to accumulate of the fact that not only were atoms real, but they also had a discrete internal structure. They consisted of a hard central nucleus, which it wouldn't evolve until later, until the early 1930s, but that nucleus consists of protons and neutrons and electrons that circulate around the outside. One of the dichotomies of that kind of model is that if it was imagined as a kind of planetary structure, a bit like the Earth orbiting the Sun, then by definition that's a model that's inherently unstable in physical terms. If the electron is a bit of charged matter spinning around a nucleus in an electromagnetic field, which it would be, then kind of by definition the physics would demand that the electron actually radiates. It gives up its energy, spirals very quickly into the nucleus, and the atom, the architecture of the atom, just collapses. And this was a real puzzle. I mean, how did you resolve the fact that if atoms had this internal structure and you'd imagine them a little bit like this, how could you square that with the fact that, of course, atoms are stable because we exist, after all? The solution was, in fact, long in coming. It didn't really come until the early 1920s. And Bohr's theory of the atom was really a kind of staging post. It was a kind of intermediate picture on the way. Bohr didn't trouble so much about trying to explain why electrons were stable inside the atom. He just took it as a fact that they were, which is a good place to start, and was able to deduce or come up with a theory that explained how it was possible to understand atomic spectra. These are pictures of the internal structure of the atom, if you like, that are taken as a result of irradiating the atoms with different wavelengths of light and looking at the light that's emitted and the light that's absorbed. So these atoms give us a little window, if you like, on the structure of the atom and tell us a little bit more about how it's made up. What Bohr was able to do was to come up with a theory that said, in fact, if he assumed that these orbits of the electron around the atom were quantized, in other words, only very discrete orbits like an Earth orbit, like a Jupiter orbit, like a Saturn orbit, only those discrete units orbits were possible and no others were possible, then he could explain the spectra of these atoms.
So at this point, let's also bring then Wolfgang Pauli into this as well, because his exclusion principle is the thing that then explains also why the atom does not collapse on itself. So.
Well, one of the interesting things about this period of the history of physics is that, unlike today, that if you were a theoretical physicist in the 1920s, it must have been a really tormented activity. You were constantly faced with baffling experimental results that really you would struggle to explain in terms of the prevailing theories of physics that were available at that time. Pauli, in particular, is quoted as having bumped into someone in the middle of Copenhagen and declared to be in some distress because he couldn't understand the...
They said, why are you? Why the long face?
Basically. Yeah, why the long face?
Did he reply, how could anybody be?
How could anybody be happy with the result of some anomaly, some experimental anomalies that he was struggling to explain? Part of the explanation that Pauli again eventually came up with was that the electron can exist in two possible spin states. So again, the term spin is very evocative because we think again of the Earth spinning on its axis as it orbits the Sun. But spin is being used in this context in a very, very different sort of way. In fact, in truth, it's odd because the spin is connected with what we understand to be properties related to angular momentum in the atom. But it shouldn't be interpreted as the electron spinning like a tiny little bit of matter spinning on its axis. Spin has actually no counterpart in classical physics at all. It's an entirely relativistic quantum effect. But nevertheless, the result of the quantization of this spin meant that the electrons could take up either spin up or spin down orientations, and a stable configuration of two electrons, like in a filled atomic orbit, those two electrons could be accommodated, provided their spins were paired.
Just before we move on to the next bit, I'm kind of fascinated by the fact that scientists seem to have two different approaches to the fact that they're getting this sort of bizarre data when they were doing their experiments on the atoms. I wonder if you could sort of quickly just look at that. I mean, there was Bohr, for example, said there is no quantum world. He didn't seem to be especially interested in how these things were happening. He just was interested in the results.
Well, that was almost a reaction in many ways to the way that quantum theory evolved in the early to mid-1920s. By that time, Heisenberg had discovered his uncertainty principle. The structure of quantum theory, pretty much as we know it today, was largely in place. I mean, it's undergone tremendous evolution since then, but certainly the basic principles of quantum behavior were pretty well understood by the mid to late 1920s. And this aspect of kind of wave-particle duality begs a question. Okay, so we can have a certain type of experiment which shows us the electron is a wave. We can diffract it. We can form interference patterns with it and so on, or with a beam of electrons. We can also be clear that the electron is a particle. When we look at the pattern of electron detection in a piece of photographic film, for example, the result is a very, very clear spot that says an electron struck here. And this is quite difficult to square. You might then ask yourself the question, OK, so here it's a wave, so here it's a particle. So what is it? What is fundamentally an elementary particle like an electron in the quantum world? How am I meant to understand its behaviour? How am I meant to interpret it? And Bohr's argument was, in effect, these are questions we actually can't answer. These are going beyond the realms where physics can actually say anything meaningful, because we're into a situation where measurement has such an important effect. Here we measure the wave behaviour, here we measure the particle behaviour. And the minute we contaminate the theories with the idea of needing a measurement to make things real in that sense, really a wave or really a particle, it becomes really then a kind of moot philosophical point as to try to answer the question, well, what is it?
And presumably if this was raged against scientists who thought, well, we can. The whole history of science until now has been we've observed stuff and we've been able to explain it.
There's a view. I mean, scientists are not philosophers, and they shouldn't be. Leave philosophers to argue their delicate philosophical points do what they need to do. Scientists are much more pragmatic, generally speaking. Scientists don't like to be told that's the end of the story. There's nothing more to learn. So the interpretation that Bohr was giving to quantum theory in the 1920s sat, in some instances, quite uncomfortably First of all, with physicists like Einstein, a theorist like Einstein, who was very much a realist. He believed in the discrete existence of these entities, whatever they were, however you wanted to describe them, and spent a long time trying to reconcile aspects of quantum mechanics with aspects of his own theories of relativity. But nevertheless, it's quite clear that the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is what it became, left a lot of physicists... Well, it left a lot of them satisfied for a good long time. But in the 1950s, 1960s, some theoretical physicists began to wake up and ask themselves awkward questions about whether this indeed was the end or whether there was something more to be learned.
You're listening to Little Atoms tonight with me, Neil Denny, and Richard Sanderson, and we're talking to science writer Jim Baggett about his book, The Quantum Story. So, well, I was going to move us on to the Copenhagen interpretation next, but you've mentioned that, so and we're very swiftly flying through the show. At this point, then, after that, there's a whole section that you talk about again in this book about the war and the race for the bomb, which I'm going to refer everybody back to the previous interview on Little Atoms we did with Jim and his book Atomic, which is absolutely wonderful. And I want us to take a bit of a... Oh, I'm actually going to say quantum leap, a bit of a quantum leap forward. And let's talk about so later developments, which are things we've never actually talked about on the show. That's what I'm trying to get to. And let's bring in Richard Feynman and the point where we get to the idea of quantum electrodynamics.
Well, this was actually one of the motivations for writing this book. Quite often, if you go into a bookstore and you pick up a book on quantum theory, obviously the fascinating aspects of the theory are this weirdness, this mm-hmm. inherent uncertainty and peculiarity at the heart of the atom. And that's great. That's a piece of history that actually many popular science readers are probably quite familiar with by now. There are plenty of really good books out there that you can read to give you that background. But the story didn't end in the 1930s with things like Schrödinger's cat and the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox or challenge, depending on how you want to think about it. Quantum theory as a theory has evolved much since the end of the war through the 1940s, late 1940s, 50s, 60s. And what I wanted to do then was to write a book that really put this history in its in proper perspective. So after the war, physicists in America, for example, were greeted as heroes because many of them, like Robert Oppenheimer, Richard Feynman, had worked on the Manhattan Project. But quantum theory was in crisis. Theoretical physicists were faced with ever increasingly precise experimental data that simply didn't fit with the expectations of the theories. And one of the realizations was that having come this far with the structure of the theory, what was needed was almost a kind of quantum version of Maxwell's electromagnetic theory. And work in the late 1940s effectively put that theory into place, but it was not simple. It was not straightforward. And one of the problems was that the conception in the structure of the theory was that if you think about an electron, you think about it as a particle of a fundamental electron field. Then one of the things you have to deal with in the theory, results in some complex mathematics, but in effect that electron is capable of interacting with its own field, and that causes the mathematical equations to blow up in your face almost. So overcoming that challenge through a process that was called renormalization was a major, major challenge for physicists in the late 1940s, early 50s. And it took quite a long while before there was a version of quantum electrodynamics, which is effectively a quantum version of Maxwell's theory.
You describe the idea that after the late sort of 50s, sort of early 60s, is the point where basically the idea of quantum theory becomes indivisible from the advances in particle physics. So let's get into that a little bit. And I want to talk particularly, and I know Richard does as well, about Murray Gell-Mann and his theory of quarks.
Yeah, well, firstly, because I love the fact that the word quark came from James Joyce. And it's a fascinating fact. It actually comes from a sentence in Finnegan's Wake, which gives us a bizarre idea that that these scientists who are dealing with the most mind-boggling avant-garde end of physics spend their leisure time reading James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, which is, I can attest, a very tough read indeed. So, yes, tell us about quarks, please.
Well, Gell-Mann was a singular personality in the history of physics. There's absolutely no doubt about that. I mean, he was a child prodigy. He went to Harvard at the age of 15. I'd just ask yourself the question, what were you doing at the age of 15? Chances are you weren't studying at Harvard. And he also had a tendency to react to what he always regarded as kind of pretentious scientific language. So much of the major discoveries that he's associated with often have kind of quirky names that he's given to them. And Gell-Mann's contribution really was kind of twofold. He made lots and lots of advances, but he's probably best known for two advances. Firstly, as physicists began to build ever larger particle accelerators in the 1950s. Or, firstly, they studied cosmic rays atop a mountain. You can go and study particle collisions, high energy particle collisions at the top of the mountain, or you can then start to construct collisions in the laboratory artificially using an accelerator. And as we came to get to grips with how to construct these accelerators, we started to probe these collisions at ever higher energies. And the result was not what you wanted. You might hope that at the end of the day, the underlying fundamental constituents of all matter are quite simple, but it turned out not to be the case. What the physicists discovered was more and more complex particles. A whole zoo of particles were discovered in the 50s and 60s. And in wrestling to come up with some kind of order to try to impose some kind of sense into this zoo of particles, Gell-Mann firstly came up with the idea that there existed another property that was responsible for some of these particles, which he called strangeness, quoting Bacon, some strangeness in the proportion. And then went on to reconcile this zoo of particles in terms of effectively a fundamental triplet of particles, which are the objects he referred to as quarks. These were bizarre and, in fact, had a kind of intriguing and rather tentative birth as a theoretical concept, because Gell-Mann himself was rather cagey about whether he thought they were real or not. But in essence, the constituents of protons and neutrons were thought to be up and down quarks, and strange quarks were introduced as a way of explaining some of the other particles that by then had been found.
Coming out of this at the same time is another physicist, Higgs, and we've talked numerous times on the show about Higgs and the Higgs particle, and so let's bring us right up to the present day. Let's have a little look at what, you know, there's the Large Hadron Collider. We know what it's looking for. You know, what else? Yeah. What else can we expect?
Well, it's worth just going back very, very quickly over where that idea came from. In effect, it was understood that two fundamental forces, the electromagnetic force and the weak nuclear force, mm-hmm. at some stage, not long after the Big Bang origin of the universe, were one and the same force, that they had become disconnected, they'd become separated. And the reason for the very different properties of these two forces today is because the carriers of that weak nuclear force are very, very big particles. They're called the W and Z particles. Whereas the carrier of the electromagnetic force, which is the photon, is massless, very light. And this is a puzzle. Why this big difference? And the difference was effectively explained by Peter Higgs and other physicists who were involved in developing the mechanism around the same time in about 1964, who said perhaps there exists throughout the universe a field which these particles interact with. What's intriguing about this field is that, and you may have had commentators who've talked about the origin of mass. If you've ever thought of mass as a primary quality of material substance, mass is something it's inherent in stuff. Mm-hmm. What this theory seems to suggest is that that's not true at all. It's actually a consequence. It's a secondary property. As particles interact with the Higgs field, they meet resistance. They slow down. And that slowing down we interpret as inertial mass. So W and Z particles gain mass through interaction with the Higgs field. The photons don't. They continue unimpeded. This is a great solution to a major problem in what was becoming the standard model of particle physics, which evolved in the late 1970s. The only problem with it is that it was used successfully to predict the masses of the W and Z particles, and they were found at CERN in 1983, precisely where they were expected to be found, which was great. It seemed to suggest the theory was working. But, of course, seeing is believing. We tend not to believe the field is really there unless we can find evidence for its telltale field particle, which is the mystical Higgs boson, which is what the Large Hadron Collider at CERN is now possibly very, very close to finding.
We're rapidly coming to the end of the show. I wanted to take us on to, in the direction of a theory of everything. We've had, rather superficial look through the entire history of quantum physics. Can you sum up in a sentence or two that where quantum physics is now, where it's going, and you know this sort of idea? Yeah, we were talking about this in the pub earlier. You raised this fantastic phrase, which you called fairy tale physics. What do you mean by that?
That's a whole different discussion.
That's for another day. That's for the, it's for possibly the next for time you're on day. The show. Yeah.
So this Higgs boson is a big deal. It's a huge deal. The positive attitude in me says that given the way that the Large Hadron Collider has been working in the last 3 or 4 months, we could be literally a few weeks away from some magical announcement.
Tremendously exciting.
It is tremendously
you heard
exciting.
It here
I'm actually personally
probably
going
not
to,
first,
I'm going to visit CERN next week. Not that I expect to be able to find anything, but I want to. I know that the guys aren't sleeping. They're analysing the data through the night. It's an incredibly exciting place right now, and I want to try and get some of the feel for that. In terms of where quantum theory is going, or theories of physics are going, it's really difficult. If the Higgs is discovered this summer, it'll be the first new particle to be discovered in a decade. And it really will kind of put the icing on the cake of the standard model. If it isn't found, or if other new particles are found, then it's a whole new ball game. We almost have to rip up the script and start again. And actually, we don't know what to expect. It's very exciting for that reason also.
Thank you very much. The book that we've been talking about is The Quantum Story by our guest Jim Baggott. It's published by Oxford University Press. You've been listening to Little Atoms. Thank you very much indeed.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.